Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 13th of June, these are our main stories. The European Union has urged the authorities in Hong Kong to respect the rights of their citizens following violent protests against a new proposed law allowing extradition to China. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who's making a historic visit to Iran, says he intends to ease the confrontation between Tehran and Washington. The World Health Organization has called an emergency meeting in response to the news that Ebola has spread to Uganda from eastern Congo. Also in this podcast,
he was on a practice ride earlier on. He was really scouting out the course when he crashed. It's emerged he's now suffered a suspected broken femur.
A favourite to take a record fifth Tour de France cycling crown is out of action with a broken leg. The European Union has called on Hong Kong to respect the rights of its citizens following violent protests over plans to allow extradition to mainland China. The EU foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, said European countries shared many of the concerns raised by citizens of Hong Kong regarding the government's extradition reforms. Britain, which returned the territory to China in 1997, urged Hong Kong to listen to the concerns of its people and its friends in the international community. Chloe Tilley spoke to Priscilla, who is on a hunger strike on a bridge near the Legislative Council complex in the city.
We had a march last Sunday, and there were more than a million people who marched out to protest against the amendments of the extradition law. Obviously, the government doesn't listen to us, but then it doesn't actually echo us. So when we have this kind of request, they simply just ignore it.
So explain to people listening around the world why you are so opposed to this extradition bill.
The bill itself is very evil. We have had this bill already, but then this amendment this time, it will repatriate people back to China to receive unjust treatment from the Chinese government. For example, you know, in 1989, we had this Tiananmen June 4th massacre. Many people from China, they fled to Hong Kong, and Hong Kong actually became their refuge. So when this bill is passed, obviously it is very, very likely that they will get repatriated to China, and I don't want that to happen.
You've also begun a hunger strike, I understand.
Yes, the hunger strike actually started this morning. 18 to 21 of us, we actually started this.
So now, are you still amongst the protesters? What can you see now?
The protesters were actually clear now. They are now clear by the police, and every road here is now cleared and full of rubbish. It's sad. I want to highlight it's not what it consists of. It's the mood of it. It's just like a few hours ago, it was filled with people who were very passionate, but then now it's empty. Not even cars. So the whole mood is very depressing.
Meanwhile, Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam accused the protesters of carrying out organised riots following violent clashes over the legislation. Our correspondent Gabriel Gatehouse spoke to us from outside the Legislative Council building.
The fact that the protesters aren't here right now does not mean that they've gone away. These people, many of them very young, lots of them school children, people are angry and worried about where this city is going. And I don't think that anger is going to go away. I think we are likely to see more protests and probably quite soon. Now, in terms of the bill, that's a different question. Protesters did manage to get the reading cancelled today, so it didn't go through. But the authorities here are going to press ahead with it. They say they're determined to, and they'll probably pass the law by the end of the month. Now, to be fair to them, they say there are safeguards in place. The Hong Kong chief executive has to approve any extraditions. It has to go through the Hong Kong legal process. But the protesters say, look, the relationship between Beijing and Hong Kong is not a relationship of equals. And if Beijing wants to extradite someone hard enough, it will be very hard for the authorities here to resist. And that, they say, is a huge chip off the block of the arrangement of one country, two systems, which is the system that Britain and China agreed in 1997, or rather in the 1980s under Thatcher, and signed in 1997 during the handover. And many people here feel that Britain in particular made a promise to them, a promise to try to uphold that system, one country, two systems, and that's a promise that they are not now fulfilling.
Gabriel Gatehouse. Emily Lau is a former member of the Hong Kong Legislature and former chairperson of the Hong Kong Democratic Party. It was past midnight local time when Tim Franks got through to her. What were her reflections on a long and turbulent day?
Of course, I was horrified, and I'm quite sure that most Hong Kong people were just shell-shocked. As you probably know, the Hong Kong administration has been talking to the Chinese authorities about some comprehensive arrangement for rendition. You know, you use this word when it's within the same country. And for over 20 years, we could not get anywhere. Why? Because the two legal systems are so different. We have the rule of law here, you know, the British tradition, independent judiciary. Over there, it's complete lawlessness. So you cannot at all be sure that if you send a person there, that he or she will get a fair trial. So we got nowhere for 20-odd years. And suddenly, bingo, the chief executive, Carrie Lam, thinks that she can get it done within months. With no public consultation. That's why a few days ago, a million people marched. And then today, you see tens of thousands of people surrounding the Legislative Council complex. I think Carrie Lam has gone mad.
But the protesters themselves, would you acknowledge that some of them were involved in violence, that they threw things at the police, and that they were, at least some of them, who were involved in what Carrie Lam, the chief executive, described as an organised riot?
Some of their behaviour was quite violent. Yes, we can see it on the screen. I do not support that. I've been in politics all my life. I never support violence. I say to some of the young people for years, I said, you want violence? Can you be more violent than the police? Can you be more violent than the People's Liberation Army? But they are adults, although they are young adults. They take responsibility for their actions. But I think underlying it is their sense of frustration. They don't think they have a good future to look forward to. And then now you have this extradition bill and people could be sent to China. That make them even more worried.
The government's argument is that this is an extradition bill that is targeted at specific crimes that any political offence would not be included in this, and that it is just trying to ensure that people don't use Hong Kong as some sort of criminal safe haven.
As I said to you, we have been trying for over 20 years to reach an agreement. Britain deliberately set up this firewall. It's not a loophole. It's a deliberate attempt to separate Hong Kong from the rest of mainland China. And have we been turned into a haven for fugitives? No. In fact, Hong Kong is known as one of the safest and most peaceful city in the world. The most fundamental thing is we have the rule of law. We want to respect that. And you heard about the case in New Zealand yesterday. The Chinese have asked the New Zealand government to extradite someone back to China, and that was about 5-6 years ago. The government agreed to extradite, and yesterday the Court of Appeal in New Zealand, the judge said, hey, wait a minute. You can't guarantee that he would get a fair trial or he would not be tortured. So I think the government should not extradite him. So we are not alone, I can tell you. There are certain principles that we should not bend.
That was Emily Lau, former chairperson of the Hong Kong Democratic Party. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says he wants to play a role in efforts to ease the escalating tensions between Iran and its US-backed neighbours. Mr. Abe was speaking during a visit to Tehran, the first by a Japanese leader for more than 40 years. After what he described as candid talks with President Hassan Rouhani, Mr. Abe said war had to be avoided at all costs.
The road to this point was long, but I believe the path from here is wide and has good views. We must both work towards that. It will require much effort, but we must do so for the peace of the Middle East region and the world. Towards that goal, Japan is determined to not give up and fulfil its part to the utmost.
On Thursday, Mr. Abe will see Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Japan has long-standing ties with both the United States and Iran, and the Prime Minister, who is hoping to boost his diplomatic profile, has good personal relations too. Rana Rahimpour from the BBC's Persian service told me more about the purpose of the visit.
Nobody believes that Mr. Abe is there because of the 90th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the two countries. Their visit comes soon after President Trump's visit to Japan. We know that the leader of Japan and the United States had a phone conversation prior to Mr. Abe's visit to Iran. And because of how high the tension is, everybody thinks that the reason Mr. Abe is in Iran is to find a solution for the current crisis between Iran and the United States.
But how much leverage would Shinzo Abe really have over Tehran?
I mean, to be honest, it depends on what he has to offer, whether he's there with an offer from the United States and what the offer is can give him leverage. But if he's just there to try to make these arch enemies friends again, there's not much he can do. There has to be a serious offer from the side of the Americans for Iran to be convinced that they can negotiate.
I mean, there are economic ties between Iran and Japan. Japan buys oil from Iran. They sell electronics to Tehran. But from what you're saying, that really doesn't matter an awful lot in this context.
No, it doesn't, because A, Iran is not the biggest oil seller to Japan. And after the Americans put sanctions on Iran oil, Japan stopped buying oil from Iran, and it was not very difficult for Japan to replace Iran. So there's not much at stake economically for the two countries. At this point, what matters is the meeting between the Supreme Leader and Mr. Abe and what he has to offer.
It seems strange to me that the United States, if indeed that is the reason for it, the United States using an intermediary that doesn't have an awful lot of leverage with Tehran, why wouldn't it choose an intermediary that had more leverage?
To think about countries that Iran is close with, Russia, China, President Trump is not friendly with either of those countries. We're talking about regional countries. We know that the foreign minister of Oman, who has a history of mediating between Iran and the US a couple of years ago, had paid unannounced visits to Iran a couple of weeks ago. So regional countries have tried to get involved. Iraq has offered to mediate. But I think Japan is a neutral country that is respected by the Iranians and the Americans. So he might be able to ease the tension between the two countries.
Rana Rahimpour from the BBC's Persian service. President Trump has said he's considering sending another 2,000 US troops to Poland amid continuing concerns about the potential military threat from Russia. At a meeting in the White House with the Polish president, Andrzej Duda, he said any soldiers would be transferred from the existing US contingent in Germany.
We have 52,000 troops in Germany. We've had them there for a long, long time. So we'd be probably moving a certain number of troops to Poland if we agree to do it. Poland's going to build a phenomenal facility in a very good location.
President Trump also said that Poland would buy more than 30 F-35 fighter jets from the US. Last year, Warsaw said it was willing to spend $2 billion to build a permanent US military base in Poland. President Duda suggested it could be called Fort Trump. Faked videos feature increasingly often on social media. Many social media users are taken in by them, including a recent doctored clip of the US House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. It appeared on Facebook, but the social media giant refused to remove it. Facebook has now said it won't even take down a false video of its own boss, Mark Zuckerberg, from Instagram, in which he appears to credit a secret organisation with his success. Here's our technology correspondent, Rory Ketlin-Jones.
Facebook has been under fire recently over its handling of misinformation and fake or manipulated videos. When a distorted video of the US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi went viral, the social media firm made sure it appeared less frequently but did not remove it. So when a video of its chief executive appeared on Instagram, owned by Facebook, the company faced a dilemma. The face was Mark Zuckerberg's, the words coming out of his mouth were not his.
Imagine this for a second. One man with total control of billions of people's stolen data, all their secrets, their lives, their futures. I owe it all to Spectre.
Bill Posters, one of the two artists behind the video, said it was part of an exhibition illustrating Facebook's huge power over many aspects of modern life, including elections.
Whilst this video is quite provocative, it is a piece of digital art. It's really important that we engage in a much broader debate because there is not enough being done to safeguard our privacies. And history shows us that you can't have democracy without privacy. And that expands to all of our personal data that's extracted all the time. There are serious questions around the safety of our data, the control and monopoly that people like Mark Zuckerberg have over billions of people's private, intimate information and how they use, trade, sell and influence us as a result.
Facebook said it would treat this like any other misinformation on Instagram, making it less visible if it was deemed misleading by fact-checkers, but not removing it. The Mark Zuckerberg video is unlikely to have fooled anyone. But as what is known as deepfake technology gets ever more sophisticated, spotting manipulated videos and deciding what to do with them will prove a growing challenge for Facebook.
Rory Kethlen-Jones. Now, what about this? A robot spider cartwheeling across the surface of Mars, or a fish transporting human organs over vast distances? It all sounds pretty fantastical, but if you've been listening to the 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter podcast, you'll know there are actually real ways that science has learnt from the animal kingdom. Every week, Patrick Airy takes a different animal and explores the human innovations they've inspired. That's 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter from the BBC World Service. Search for 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter wherever you found this podcast. For months, health officials have been trying to contain the Ebola outbreak in Central Africa to one country, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there have been over 2,000 cases. Those attempts seem to have failed, because a five-year-old boy has now become the first person in Uganda to die of Ebola during this recent outbreak. His younger brother and his grandmother also have the disease. The Ugandan authorities have now placed seven more family members in isolation, and they're monitoring 50 people who've been in close contact with them. Dealing with the outbreak in Uganda is the country's health minister, Dr. Jane Ruth Acheng. Tim Frank spoke to her as she was on the road with officials from the WHO.
Well, we have three confirmed cases and seven suspect cases and 50 contacts that we are following up. And this a family that came in from the DRC.
Right, so they're all from the same family. I guess it's a cause of some concern to you who they in turn have been in contact with. What's it been like trying to trace all the people that they may have been in the presence of since the infection spread?
Well, indeed, it's a challenge. However, the DRC informed us about these people crossing into the country. And so we had all our facilities and our communities alerted. And so it wasn't difficult to have them quickly isolated and tested.
Ugandans are aware about Ebola. We don't mix it with myths and misconceptions, and the teams will manage the cases accordingly.
I guess it's difficult for you as the health minister to tread the path between saying we've got things under control, there's no need for panic, but at the same time trying to get people to take this very, very seriously, because obviously I don't need to tell you about the terrible effects that Ebola can have once the disease takes hold, once an epidemic strikes.
Well, you're absolutely right. First, Ebola itself means death, and nobody wants anyone to die. One death is one too many. And as you have correctly said, it has devastating effects on a country's economy. And yes, right, it is a delicate balance. You cannot be oversure. But we do have partners in country who are giving a lot of support. They've been doing this for the last 10 months. So our strength lies in community sensitization and getting them to respond and be quick to inform the health workers.
How unusual is it for Uganda to have a confirmed case of Ebola?
Well, since the year 2000, Uganda has had nearly 5 outbreaks of Ebola. And if you're asking whether I have been involved in all of them, I will say yes, except the one of the year 2000, because I was a frontline health worker. But for the other parts, I have been the technical head and the minister. So Ebola is not new to me. I have been in the field. I know what it means. I know how to prepare. I know how to talk to my people about it. And that is why I am speaking with confidence as a technical person who has handled Ebola myself, but also as a policy leader who has given leadership in the handling of Ebola.
That was Uganda's Health Minister, Dr. Jane Ruth Acheng. Saudi Arabia has suggested that Iran was linked to a missile attack on a Saudi airport launched by Houthi rebels in Yemen. The Saudi-led coalition, which backs Yemen's government in its war with the Houthis, implied that the attack on Wednesday showed that Tehran was helping the rebels acquire advanced weapons. Paul Adams reports.
The missile hit Abha Airport, 200 kilometres from the Yemeni border, in the early hours of the morning. The Houthis say it destroyed the control tower, but a statement from the Saudi-led military coalition said it hit the arrivals hall, injuring 26 people, including women and children. It's not clear what sort of projectile was involved. The Houthis say they fired a cruise missile. While not unprecedented, this would be unusual, and it hasn't been confirmed by the coalition. But its statement did say the attack proved the Houthis had acquired what it called new special weapons.
Paul Adams, and Iran says it denies supplying the Houthis with weapons. India has announced ambitious plans to launch a mission to the moon. If it succeeds in landing a rover on the lunar surface in September, it would become only the fourth country to do so. Here's our South Asia editor, Jill McGivory.
Officials at India's space agency said the components for the unmanned mission, including a lander, an orbiter and a rover, had been built by its own experts. The project has an overall cost of almost $150 million. This is India's second lunar mission. In 2008, it put a spacecraft into orbit round the moon, but it didn't land on the surface. Analysts say the current Indian government seems eager to pursue the country's space programme, a prestige project which fosters national pride.
Jill McGivory. The world's greatest cycling road race, the Tour de France, is just 3 weeks away. But Chris Froome, who would have been the favourite to achieve a record-equalling fifth victory, will now not be taking part. That's because the British cyclist had a high-speed crash in a practice session in central France. Our sports news correspondent, Andy Swiss, told me what happened.
Well, Nick, he's been competing at a race called the Critérium du Dauphiné in France. It's one of the traditional preparation events for the Tour de France, really. And what we know is that he was on a practice ride earlier on. He was really scouting out the course ahead of today's stage in Roanne when he crashed. It's emerged he's now suffered a suspected broken femur. So effectively, he's broken his leg. We have heard from the principal of his team, Sir Dave Brailsford, who's been talking to French television. He said that Chris Froome crashed in the downhill section of the course at high speed. He hit a wall. The ambulance came quickly. He's been taken care of and is waiting for a helicopter to be transferred to hospital. He's since been quoted, interestingly, talking to another media outlet, giving a few more details. He said that Chris Froome was at the foot of a descent and it's obviously very gusty today, and he took his hands off the bars to blow his nose, and the wind has taken his front wheel. And today, Brailsford said he hit a wall at 60 kilometres an hour or something like that. And as a result of that, he's got a bad fracture. So it really does sound like a nasty accident. And obviously, everyone will be wishing Chris Froome a speedy recovery from this.
And of course, this comes at a time when he's just about to go for this record-equalling fifth Tour de France. How much of a blow is it for him and also for the race itself?
Well, it's certainly a huge blow as far as Chris Froome is concerned. As you say, he has really dominated the Tour de France in recent years. Last year, he finished third, in fact, behind his teammate Geraint Thomas. But Froome had high hopes of what would be a record-equalling fifth victory in the Tour de France. Only four riders have previously won five Tour de Frances, so it really would be some achievement, but clearly those hopes have now disappeared as a result of this injury. And the other thing I suppose that Chris Froome will be thinking about is he's now 34, so there may not be many more chances to achieve this record-equalling fifth title. So clearly he'll be very disappointed, but I suppose the priority has to be his recuperation from what sounds like a really, really nasty accident.
So the Tour de France will go ahead, starting early next month. So who's likely to take over as the top contender now?
Well, I suppose now people will be looking at last year's champion, Geraint Thomas, who was a surprise winner last year. I mean, people were looking at Chris Froome very much as the favourite going into last year's Tour de France. People were expecting him to get that record-equalling fifth title last year. But it's, in fact, his teammate, Geraint Thomas of Wales, who came through to win. Now, I think many people had expected that Froome would once again be the main contender for Team Ineos, who is the new team that's emerged from the embers of Team Sky. But as a result of this, Froome won't be there, and I think people will once again be looking at Geraint Thomas to make it two in a row.
That was Andy Swiss. The major British charity Comic Relief has said that it's going to send fewer celebrities abroad for its campaigns. That's after it was criticised for allegedly perpetrating the white saviour myth. The UK politician David Lammy, who's accused the organisation of tired and harmful stereotypes, has welcomed the decision. Charlotte Gallagher has been following the story.
Last thing I always wanted this trip to be was to be the celebrity who comes over to Africa and cries on TV.
For decades, Comic Relief has relied on the power of celebrities to raise money for good causes. This was Ed Sheeran when he went to Liberia in 2017.
This is always what celebrities do. And I always think, is it really that bad? And then I sort of turn up and, yes, it is.
But some have criticised the celebrity trips, calling them poverty porn and accusing the stars of acting like white saviours in African countries. The Ed Sheeran documentary was even given an award for the most offensive and stereotypical fundraising video of the year. In February, the documentary maker Stacey Dooley came under fire when she travelled to Uganda for the charity. She posted photos on Instagram of her holding a young Ugandan child with the caption, "Obsessed." The MP David Lammy accused her and Comic Relief of giving a distorted image of Africa, which perpetuated ideas from the colonial era. One of the founders of Comic Relief, the filmmaker Richard Curtis, has said it will now send fewer celebrities abroad and will instead give voices to people who actually live there. He said he'd listened to the criticism and was addressing it.
Charlotte Gallagher. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.